The Cyber Show is pre-recorded from our studios in Pebble Beach, California. This show is sponsored by Management Analytics, trusted advisor since 1977.
Hi, I'm Fred.
And I'm Chris.
And this is The Cyber Show.
Would you like to have some cyber fun? Join the show and the fun will come.
This week on The Cyber Show, it's a whole new year, so things will be changing. Pete is exploited as a child because he's able to exploit other things. Rand creates a thinking machine, or not. Ron goes somewhere over the rainbow series. More fraud, spies, and lies, and a whole lot more. Only on The Cyber Show. Here we go.
No politics, no religion, none of the seven dirty words. Don't believe what anyone on the show tells you. Check it out for yourself. The views expressed do not reflect those of the management or owners of the station, the websites involved, the sponsors, or anyone other than the individuals expressing them, and in many cases, not even them.
Everyone, we have an announcement to make.
Enterprise Leadership Network provides an intimate forum for C-level executives to gather and discuss key issues of the day. ELN is about building community, innovation, and collaboration with other ambitious, high-performing enterprise leaders through the exchange of ideas and information. You'll be able to participate in roundtable discussions, intimate in-person conferences, networking dinner events in your area, and a national forum. When you join Enterprise Leadership Network, ELN, you are welcomed into the fold of a private network of C-suite, senior executives, and accomplished VPs where you can build a solid network of peer relationships, carve out an executive career path, build your executive presence, and learn how to become a leadership and executive influencer. As an angel to exit portfolio company, other portfolio companies enjoy special privileges and access to ELN events, and help host online forums, panels, and events. Take advantage of this unique opportunity to build relationships, grow your company, and affect positive change by attending and participating or sponsoring these outstanding networking events. To join other executives, become a member at ELN3.com today and grow your executive network.
That was absolutely amazing.
Breaking news on The Cyber Show. 2024 is looking to be a banner year for online influence operations. Increased use of automation and attack is not being adequately met by defenses. And funding for exploitation far exceeds funding for counter-influence operations because of the vast sums of money to be made by manipulating people. And that's what will be breaking news on The Cyber Show. How do we know we're being successful at The Cyber Show? Well, here are the five ways we know today. One, we know the bad guys are listening because we get updated versions of our spam emails addressing the problems we found on the previous versions. Two, we know the broader listening audience is paying attention because they've complained about our use of terminology that should not appear on broadcast radio. Three, we know the startups are listening because we get contacts from startups looking for assistance in funding and growth. Four, we know the cybersecurity crowd is listening because they contact us on LinkedIn using email and other forums to tell us what they really think about what we say. And five, we know the elites are listening because they say, Dr. Fred Cohen, we're listening. If you want to tell us what you think, you can email us by going to thecybershow.co. If you have questions, email those questions and we'd be happy to provide on-air answers. The Cyber Show. Only on KMBY 1240 AM. We're listening. Pete Herzog can best be characterized as a hacker. He's been a hacker since he was young. He's been on both sides of the line between good and evil, if you will call it that. And his career has affected a lot of people, all the more so since he started working on open standards and Hacker High School. Here's Pete.
Continuing with Pete. Okay, so you managed to successfully bypass security at major library of university, and you got in and started to use the systems the way they were intended to be used and followed directions, except of course you were not supposed to be there. So that's where your career of finding out how to get past things and doing reasonable things when you got past them, not malicious things, started. So right. So what happened next? Well, let's move more quickly forward.
I taught myself more about FTP. I came across a prompt that said, anonymous not allowed, enter your email address. And then I learned about email. No, I didn't. So then I asked at the library the next day, how do you get an email address? And the librarian, she said, email is only allowed for researchers, and that is in the science department, or librarians. And I chose a major then, which was to be a librarian. And
okay, so you could have access to the knowledge of the world.
That's right. And that's what I did. I ended up getting a literature. Actually, I sort of switched then, since I had access to the computers and things were moving fast, and I no longer needed to get into the library anymore because they were now moving these internet accessible computers into other places. I was able to get on them anywhere, which meant I didn't have to stick with librarian. And then I just continued with English and literature, thinking that maybe I would take it into law or something else. That was my idea at that point. But it was really just about trying to be a librarian and getting access to the machine. That's really what I wanted.
Yeah, learning stuff, getting access to information so you could read and learn stuff.
Yes, I continued in the computer lab where I got really good at cracking software, and professors would come to me.
Now you've used the word cracking, which sounds more nefarious. So when you say cracking, do you mean bypassing the normal mechanisms of the software so as to gain additional functionality not normally authorized?
Yes, so they didn't have to pay for it.
Oh, okay. All right, it's about money. It's not about So you learned how to bypass controls, and you call that cracking. Interesting choice of terms. So not hacking, cracking. And why? What do you make as the distinction?
The distinction is that I think of it as software as this container, and I was cracking it open. That's how I always visualized it. Rather than opening it the way you're supposed to, I broke it open and took out what I wanted, which was the controls.
Yeah, whatever. The jewels. Okay.
Yeah.
So let's just talk a little bit about the methodologies that you used then. So can you just give me a sense of, you know, presumably you learned various tricks that worked more often than other things. How did you come by those tricks? How did you learn them? And what sort of tricks did you use?
I would ask around a lot. I used books from the library to understand what hex code was.
Hex stands for hexadecimal, right?
Yes.
Which is a base 16. Continue.
And probably talking to others, there was a small community of other students who mostly were cracking games. I was the only one cracking educational software.
So you could be educated without having to pay for it?
No, so that I could do this. So professors knew that I was able to do this. And if they wanted or to try a software, they would come to me. And in return, I would get favors.
Okay, this is now a cracking for hire, hired by the professors in the university so they could gain access, unauthorized access to software. So they were really the criminals, and you were the student who was bartering their access for what kind of favor?
You know, being able to skip on a paper or get a better grade.
Yeah, okay. Okay, so this sounds to me like, you know, these are, what's the right word for them, Bob Sagan? You know, these are criminal conspirators who are exploiting your vulnerabilities as a poor student, taking advantage of you. Not only that, they're denying you the proper education and proper evaluation of your education by allowing you to not have to do the things that actually might have benefited you later in life. You were an exploited child.
It could be. I like to not think of it that way.
In fact, that's right.
You know, at the time, I was extremely poor, right? The money I received covered some of my education, not all of it, in which case I had to work. I ended up working 3 part-time jobs while going to school. I was pretty much just eating oatmeal and baked ziti, and I would get a job usually at some kind of restaurant or a place where they allowed me to eat, so I was making sure I got one meal a day.
So you were an exploited child being taken advantage of by the professors. I think that is the only reasonable way to talk about it. Because look, you know, you're supposed to be the student. You're supposed to be the one that they're educating, and what they were teaching you was to be a criminal.
Could be. I hadn't thought of it back then. I wasn't thinking of that way. I was only thinking of graduating so I could actually get a job where I earned money and be able to eat and live my life. You know?
Yeah, absolutely. But I think the point is to be made that, you know, you're an exploited child.
Well, and I think that point can be made, you know, about a lot of us who fall down that path, you know, that maybe, you know, lack of proper support and parental supervision is a indicator of a secure career in cybersecurity.
No, but this is much different from that.
I understand what you're saying. Yes, I'm trying to make a joke of it. Yeah.
This is not only unethical and immoral, but almost certainly illegal behavior by professors in a university who are exploiting their students, their poor students, and selling grades. I mean, you know, they shut down, you know, folks at major universities for these sorts of things, but it was for more money.
Yeah, right.
But this is the worst kind of abuse, in my view, of trust, right? Here's a person who, you know, we're trusting to educate our children, who are exploiting our children for their own benefit, to have and teaching them that the right thing to do is to break into computer systems in order to pass your class so you can get a job, you know, and you know, not even giving them a meal for it, right?
I'll go back to what I said at the beginning of the first segment. I love Pete, right? You know, and I, you know, walking through that life, this is more than I knew about his past, but yeah, you're there. You're a kid, to be clear. I was happy to be called an adult when I was 18 and 21 and so forth, but you're out in the world and you're just trying to eat and get an education and get a job where you can eat, because eating is way better than not eating. Right. And I think a lot of, I wish I could remember the guy's name, but he's one of the, I'll think of the hacker group name, but they had gotten busted and we were in London at a club and going out, bowl smoke cigarettes. We're standing outside talking about this off and on through the night. And he's saying, look, you know, he popped open cash drawers and did all sorts of things, but never took the money because that's not the point. But, you know, but eating is a thing too, right? You know, and this, you could say this for any sort of, you know, crime. You know, are you doing it, you know, because you were intentionally malicious, or are you doing it to eat, right? And then you start having to looking at the people around you, particularly if you're young and vulnerable, and say, you know, this is a setup. You know, you put a hungry kid there and say, don't eat to steal the bread rolls. So it's like, he's hungry. Bread is bread.
Yeah. I find it disturbing. I find the lack of ethics of the professoriate to be disturbing. I, you know, having been a professor for a period of time, having faced a variety of ethical challenges throughout my life, as I think probably everybody does, I find that to be abhorrent. And look, the statute of limitations is over. I would love to have their names so they can be shamed.
Yep.
By now, they're probably retired. But so if you're within the sound of my voice and you know who did this, call them out. In fact,
Pete's a big kid. He was a big kid then. However, I find no wrong in him. You know, he was a kid learning how things worked, doing the best he could. But you're right. Other people, I think I'm with you. Right. You know, don't mess with
him. What he learned about how things work was
right,
that you get ahead by lying, cheating, and stealing, by being a criminal.
Mark Twain, right? Yeah, you know, that's again, you know, the one of the lessons we need to learn in trying to be ethical in anything is when something works for you and you know it's wrong, remember that second part, right? You know, because it, you know, one wrong leads to another and yada, yada, yada. And it's less about ending up in jail. It's more about ending up having a bad life, right? And I think Pete's going on to have a good life, but these are the risks you take, right? And I worry about, well, if I cared who, you know, about the professor in context, I would guess that they're not really happy, because if you're, you know, abusing things and you know it, you're probably just a miserable person. And someday you get caught, suffer.
I think people justify this stuff. They conclude that they're right. Hey, I was only a poor professor. They didn't pay me enough. The university should have provided it to me, right? I mean, yeah, this is part of the whole, the world owes me something. And if the world doesn't give it to me, I'm going to take it, right? Because, you know, this is not food, right? The professors were able to eat. For Pete, Maybe it was food, right?
Yeah, working three jobs, trying to go to school, you know, figuring everything out on your own. That's a heavy lift. You know, I'm proud of him for making, be proud of any, you know, kid out there doing that today that comes out to this side good. Because a lot of ways to become the professor in this case. Right, you find out that works, then you go, you know, stay in academia and become one of those guys, knowing all the time it's the wrong path.
Well, there's also exploitation of students for sex.
Ugh.
Right? Sex for grades is another thing that happens. And, you know, when I was a professor at one point, I had a student who offered to go out on a date with me because she really liked me. And I explained to her that I would be happy to do that as soon as the course was over. And after she got her grade, assuming she was still interested at that point, her grade wasn't going to be that good. And she knew it. But she glommed on to another a teaching assistant, and they started dating. So I presume that she passed whatever course he was in charge of. But, you know, this cannot be that unusual, right? So,
well, I gotta say, we're on the cyber show, right? You know, and my experience, to be clear, you know, with 30 years in, you know, mostly American corporations, is I've seen little or almost no corruption of any sort. You know, all the stuff that shows up in Hollywood movies and so forth, backroom deals, behind the scenes, and everything else. Like, you know, in a good, this is why I like, you know, capitalism, you know, a lot, right? You know, though I have different ideological views that may seem to clash with that. Because I think good capitalism is extremely honest, because all that crazy nonsense is risky. And good businessmen, good business people don't get involved in underhanded things, because the consequence can be you lose everything. And if you can set up a good business where you're really clear with everybody else all the time, and you know, you have employees and say, okay, here's the things we don't do. Seriously, I'll fire you immediately if you do any of those things. You can build a business that actually works really well. I've seen it. You know, John Chambers of Cisco gets a shout out. You know, when I became a manager at Cisco, there's a management training class you had to take, and John Chambers, the CEO at the time, would give a short talk to every class, every single one. And I'm a front row center sort of person, anyways. So I always say at the front. He's got, you know, John puts his water glass right in front of me, and gives this nice, happy, you know, sort of talk, and then basically says, "And you're responsible for it to me." And it all just came together to me. It's like what he's saying is that if we're on CNN for doing something unethical, you're going to be standing in front of my desk. Guess what? It's going to be a bad day. So for 4 years, you know, working there, traveling the world, and all these business deals, you know, huge, amazing amount of business deals, I didn't see the kind of stuff in Hollywood, you know, cynical, you know, systems.
That's because you're an employee to some, you know, very legitimate, large, longstanding corporations, right? I, on the other hand, spent a great deal of my career in the investigation space, in the something bad happened space, in the cybersecurity oops space. And in that space, we see a lot of the other side of it. And it's not that it's rampant. It's almost always, and in my experience, there's one or two or maybe three or four people colluding, which is rare. It's almost always one and occasionally two. You know, that number of insiders that are doing something wrong. And when caught, you know, it's a shame. I mean, it's terrible for the company. It sucks. For every other worker there, it's, you know, tears your heart out, you know, because you're working honestly for this company, trying to do your job. And you do see a lot of infighting. And I know you're aware of a lot of office politics. And sure, that's not exactly what I would call ethical.
No. It depends what you do with it. It's so, you know, this, you know, sociology is a part of a business as well. Like, you can do your job perfectly and anger everybody around you, and that's not doing your job perfectly. Sorry.
Right. I think we ask too much of people.
I think we don't ask appropriately. You know, too much, but, you know, we quite often aren't really clear. It's like, you know, do this thing. It's like, instead of saying, okay, here's my expectations, right? I expect you to do these things in this way or whatever, right? You know, when we don't explain enough, I think to your point, when there's no boundaries. So as an employee, you know, as a designee in some case, you don't know if it's in or out. It's better to just to say, here's exactly what we expect.
So when is the cyber AI stuff going to get to the point where it, and because it's watching all the things you're doing, it's watching all these exchanges you're making via email and digital methods, and maybe listening to what you say on the phone. When is it going to come to the point where it says, I think you might be getting close to the edge with that. Here's the problem I identified, and help us do that job better. Help improve our ability to perform.
And, I think it's not far away, the capability. I think my big concern is hesitation to adopt, you know, and again, you know, don't everybody, you know, don't, you know, mix up public, you know, sentiments with actual sentiments, right? What actually media and social media and so forth isn't necessarily what 97% of the people are thinking. It's what maybe 3% of us are really freaked out about. And maybe we should all think about it a lot. But the privacy thing, you know, I've got, you know, Amazon and, you know, Alexa and so forth in my world. You know, I'm not worried about Amazon eavesdropping in my personal conversations because I don't care. And the convenience is worth it. So having AI follow us along that well, that closely, particularly as employees, if you are concerned that you have bad management or you don't trust your management and everything else, I can see that being a big, big problem. But I think the capabilities are just about there. And I think the value will be fantastic. I'm looking forward to it.
I think we're a long way from what I was trying to describe. But for example, we have one company that, you know, we're trying to get started up that's just looking at, you know, psychometric analysis of communications, digital communications. And the idea is to identify when people are getting overstressed, you know, not to get rid of them, but so that you can pay some attention and help them.
Right.
But you can also detect various kinds of nefarious activity. So, you know, I have people that work for me. There are, you know, several people that work for me in the Philippines, and we encounter a variety of things with those folks. They're all trying to do their job and trying to do their job well, but they don't necessarily read all the policy, even though we speak it to them, because that's part of my whole thing. And we go over it with them, but they don't necessarily follow it. So we try to be good about it. But at the end of the day, you know, how many times do we have to tell you, don't do that before you actually stop doing it or leave? And, you know, we give them the proper warnings. But look, good people working hard, trying to do their job, sometimes get over exuberant. And being able to detect that, to help them, to make them understand that, look, we know you're really trying hard to do your job, and that's great. And you should call us to have us help you do your job better. You should not, you know, go over the edge of the things that we say are the guardrails.
Well, and let me try to walk you through why I think it's not that far away. And again, maybe I'm just over biased because of my work in supply chain, but I see a world in the very near future where, you know, just sticking to the supply chain aspect, but I think it works in lots of things, where you can say, to your point, you know, here's the policy between us and our supplier. And literally the contract is right there. You know, you may have even read it before, but, you know, to your point, it's like you can't keep all this stuff in your heads all the time. And, you know, say that clause, and there's two policies involved here. And they kind of, if you really look at the wording, those, you know, yeah, so we're putting together, you know, automated systems over in this next decade that basically all of the companies on Earth will, you know, use. And they'll talk to these. So the point that I keep trying to make to the community working on that right now is all we're really doing is better enunciating existing relationships. And I think to your point, you add some AI to that, and in good environments, good, healthy environments, when it's being used, you know, as you're saying, just to keep an eye. I would love that, you know, having my back. It's like, you know, hey, these last couple of emails you sent, this whole thing you're working on right now, you know, realize, you know, that you're right now, you know, subject to 4 different little policy documents. And they each have clauses trying to do similar things. But it really, if you sat all those working groups together and wrote those documents, you realize that none of them really define the space you're in right now. And it's getting tricky. And a little farther, they do define it, and you're in the bad space. But that would be great to know. Because one less thing to worry about.
So look, I know the policies for my companies because I wrote them. And I teach them to other people, right? But I still run into them. You know, because it's, you know, 2 o'clock in the morning and I'm sending out some emails and, you know, and my thinking wasn't as clear as it should be, or I'm a little bit too close to that edge, you know, And especially, you know, when you're in charge, there's nobody to warn you off except yourself.
Right. High risk. So
I would like to have that warning. I would, you know, and what we have now is warnings that are ridiculous. They're so bad. They're so false positive types of warnings that you just sort of say, go away, turn off the bloody warning. You're all you're doing is stopping me from getting my job done.
The only I am inundated with alerts and messages. The only one that I consistently pay any attention to is the solar controller on the boat here. I've left the alarm set on, so it gives a beep whenever it does anything, whether it, you know, the sun comes up and it starts. So four times a day it beeps. I pay attention to that. The screen fulls of messages and alerts I get on my, you know, clear all. You know, that little thing that you put at the bottom, clear all. I don't even look at it. So yeah, we're lining up, you know, to make an evolutionary step with that. You know, it's time. And AI is good enough right now to sort through all my messages. You know, so somebody hasn't put that app on my phone yet, but as soon as they make one, I'm installing it.
Yeah, well, they certainly could learn from you, right? The ones that you dismiss. Okay.
Yeah. Stop telling me. Do I have to find the setting to tell you to stop telling me? I mean, obviously, you can, you know, autocorrect fairly well. So figure that one out.
Yeah. Well, the other one is, and Google is like the worst of all at this. You get these warnings, suspicious activity warning, and you click through and try to figure out what it is, and it tells you absolutely nothing about what the behavior was. It just says you exceeded some behavioral threshold somewhere on something. Oh, okay, thanks. But what was it? What did I do?
As I was saying to Donna, you know, the other day about, you know, banking stuff, you know, and the warnings and alerts you send, you know, fraudulent activity detected. And to be kind, you know, I know people who work, you know, worked in this part of the industry and work on it now and everything else. You guys do a great job. You know, folks are just kicking butt. However, you all know the same thing because we talked about it behind the scenes, that all those things are useless. They don't actually give any security benefit whatsoever. And, you know, the banks all have a margin they write off for fraud. And as long as it stays inside that, they, you know, it's just a rounding error. So anyways, but we'll evolve past that as well. About that one, I want AI to sort out my alerts. I want alerts that fit my world and tell me what I need to know at the time I need to know it and none of the rest. Thank you.
Yeah, liability issues, you know, the failure to warn, blah, 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 blah.
I understand. God help me. I wish I didn't sometimes.
Yes, you're going to have to sign off on every different kind of alert. They came up with 5 new alerts today, so you're going to get 5 alerts about the alerts you have to sign off on to not get alerted about them.
I have a Google Fi phone, and I finally fixed it. You know, for months and months and months, it was sending me messages telling me that it couldn't send me messages.
I love it. Well, you know, what? So where did they come up with the name Fi? Now, we're not allowed to translate that into English on the show, but I think you know what it
is. This show is brought to you by Management Analytics, trusted advisor since 1977.
We're talking with Rand Waltzman, who has a long history in the cybersecurity and artificial intelligence arena, and perhaps most importantly in the deception, counter-deception, influence operations, counter-influence operations, and related areas. Here is Rand.
So we're back with Rand, and you were talking about Hall Earth cards and such before you got your first real experience with computers. And we're going to get back to your time at DARPA and other places later. But I want to get to what you did after punching cards, after your first job that got you into the PhD program. And then we'll talk about your PhD.
Okay. I don't know what I do. I did this job. I had this, you know, the guy gave me a task to do, which was a lot of fun. He had this helmet that you put on, and what he was trying to do, this guy was on the cover of Life magazine with this helmet. I mean,
was it trying to read your mind or let you control
yes,
things?
It took readings. It took readings of, you know, the potential surface potential on your skull. And it was readings in response to, he had these people sit in a cage, and he would like have light flashing, like, you know, he would flash a light on the upper retina and the lower part of the retina on one eye, then the upper retina and the lower part of the retina on the other eye.
Trying to figure out where the brain was activated.
Yes, he was trying to actually trace the flow of currents in the brain. So he was doing what's called an inverse electromagnetic problem. So he had these potential readings every millisecond. It took a whole set of readings of all these.
So he had a three-dimensional tomographic picture of something.
Well, yeah. So he had these sensors all over the skull. And he could measure the potential all across the skull, right? And he took a whole set of readings every millisecond. So now you had all of these whole set of readings every millisecond, like 247 milliseconds. And the idea was to try to do a calculation of what the current looked like and where it went in three-dimensional space. Yeah. And to do that, he made all kinds of crazy approximations. Like you say, well, suppose it's a monopole that's traveling. Yeah, and then suppose it's a dipole. Suppose it's a quadrupole. Suppose it's an octopole. So, and you made these assumptions, and then you calculated what it looked like. But that's not what I did. So my job, right, as a lowly person there, was to take every millisecond of readings from the whole head, and then to generate equipotential maps. So you had this equipotential, each ring was a line of equipotential. Sure. And then my job was to generate those and then transfer that onto a film, and so that every frame was 1 millisecond. So then if you ran this film, you could actually see the lines changing and the equipotential lines moving in real time. So it was a way to visualize what was happening. So 1969, this is pretty sophisticated stuff. I mean,
it's probably pretty sophisticated today, but they are, by the way, of course, doing this now, right? That is, they have these helmets that you can wear that you actually do things like control quadcopters and such.
Yes. Well, we were very far from that. He just wanted to see, you know, where the you
were just before your time.
Yes, yes, yes. He was quite before his time with all of this. And but what was really funny was, so I was just a kid, and I showed up to the summer job on the first day, and I had never seen a computer. I didn't know how to program or anything. The guy on a Friday afternoon, the guy plops down on my desk 2 IBM Fortran manuals.
Of course.
And he tells me, he says, Monday, you're a programmer.
Wow. Okay.
So,
great.
So you read it, you followed directions, and you were a programmer.
And Monday I started programming. And these are IBM Fortran manuals, right? These are not textbooks. These are, you know, anybody who is familiar with IBM manuals, you know that they're basically impenetrable things, horrible things. So
no, come on. They were just perfect, right? They told you what you actually needed to know. It's yes. Just that they said so in the language of people that wrote it, not the people that were trying to explain it to you.
Well, of course, the other problem was that of all of the stuff that it told you, you had to figure out what of all of that small thing did you actually need to know? That was the other big problem, right?
You see, now I really like that. At any given time. You know, because I understood. So when I first tried it, I had maybe a PDP-8 or something like that. But they had a hardware manual and a software manual. Yeah. And so I read the hardware manual. So I understood all how the instruction set worked and how all the mechanisms worked, you know, all the toggle switches and all that stuff. Yeah. And then I read the software manual, which told you all about assembly language. And it had a basic interpreter in it as well. So I always thought about it from the inside out, right, mm-hmm. rather than from the outside in. And that, of course, drove my thinking in a completely different direction.
Yeah. Well, unfortunately, after 3 months, I wasn't able to do this thing. It didn't.
I
couldn't get it to work. And he was coming by every day. We had lots of nice conversations. I showed him what I was doing. He looked at it. And then after 3 months, I said, well, gee, I'm really sorry. It didn't work. He says, oh, I knew it wouldn't work. I said, what do you mean you knew it wouldn't work? He says, well, I came by every day. I saw what you were doing. And he says, the problem is you were trying to make the machine think. And he says, I'm sorry. It's just not, these machines aren't there yet. They're never going to do what you were trying to make them do. He says, but you made a pretty valiant effort at it. I have to say that. And he talked about what I was trying to do, why he called it trying to make the machine think. And he went through this whole explanation. And then finally he says, well, do you get it? Do you understand now why what you were trying to do couldn't possibly work? I said, yeah, I get it. Why didn't you tell me that before? He says, well, if I told you that earlier, would you have believed me? Would you have understood it? I said, well, probably not. He says, well, there you are. You got it now, right? I said, yeah. He says, well, then my money was well spent. That was my first exposure to the world of research.
So, you know, what I thought he was going to say was, well, you know, it might be that you could get it to think. And I can, you know, if you can succeed, why not go ahead?
Yeah, no, he did. No, he told me I couldn't, wasn't going to work. These machines weren't there yet. So,
okay. So, I guess.
Yeah, there's a good boss right there. You know, that's a computer apprenticeship. You know, just here, take some time, make this thing do something, watch how that's going. Don't say a word. You know, major kudos.
Well, no feedback. But I mean, I thought that, you know, my view of this, of maybe you could do it, you know, there's a fairly recent case that's widely publicized of a student, you know, some college student that got late to a math class and missed the giving of the assignment. And he saw something on the board that he thought was the assignment. So he wrote it down and came back the next week with a solution. It turns out this is a long time unsolved math problem. I mean, talking hundreds of years. And he, you know, he went and solved it, you know, oh my goodness. So I kind of thought that maybe that was the approach. Okay, if you can program them to think, that'd be great. But apparently not. And then, you know, the whole brain scan, right? People have been thinking about this for a long time. And today we actually have the ability to, you know, put this helmet on and control a quadcopter or all sorts of manipulators. I think when you look back on this, you know, I think, you know, I looked this guy up, Dr. Derek Henry Fender of the California Institute of Technology. He died at age 78 in 1997. And, you know, you look at the description of him, you know, he discovered that the eye sees as a result of a series of flicks and that the brain is limited in the complexity of the visual design and patterns and all this stuff, you know. I mean, there was, you know, at that time, a level of discovery about what's going on, you know, within people's physical being was sort of astonishing, and the amount of time and effort to get to those results. And we're still exploring this. I mean, we're nowhere close to truly understanding what the brain does.
You know, and again, this fits in my favorite theme, you know, and we're all aware of this. We all discussed this over the last 100 years, you know, basically, you know, powered flight to landing on the moon was, you know, less than 70 years. And at the same time, you know, Kurt Vonnegut, Player Piano, a great book, right? You're looking at, you know, possible downsides of automation, basically, right? But we have these ideas that we're going to have walking and talking robots in the 1980s, you know, when I was a kid in the 60s and 70s, right? It's like, no, it's much more complicated than that. And we've just recently figured things out, right? Galaxies.
Well, we haven't figured them out yet, but we certainly have them able to walk on 2 feet if we want them to. And we're talking to Ron Ross, you know, and they had their, you know, 6 foot robot, right? Their six sectoped, is it? Octoped.
It's the flying car thing, right? You know, the classic, you know, cliche of the boomers complaining that they were promised flying cars. It's like when futurists, you know, in the 40s, 50s and 60s and the 1900s were talking about flying cars. I don't know how many of them really put dates on them. I think by the time it turned into something broadcast as a science documentary, people would say, in your future, look, you know, a lot of things are possible. A lot of them are going to happen. A lot of them are more complicated. You know, flying cars. I mean, anybody who's been up in a small single engine plane knows that flying is complicated, really complicated. It takes a lot. Now we're getting there. You know, 8 motors on a cybernetic electric vehicle is working really well, you know, as a flying car prototype thing that you can see in the not too distant future.
Oh, well, they're sort of working now, but the accident problem is a little bit worse when you're up in the air, but that's so, you know, you take your risks, you know, but that's all right. So when I think about that, one of the places where I think this sort of hits home the best is when we first saw computers able to talk, we imagined that they would soon be able to listen. Because, you know, that's how we thought it works with people. We listen and learn how to talk. Yeah, no. I'm sorry. Talking is easy. Listening is hard. And I think there's a human analogy that is, you know, we can say all sorts of stuff, but paying attention to what somebody else is telling us appears to be more difficult than spewing forth our own views, as anybody listening to the show will recognize.
Well, it's just pragmatically the multilingual thing. Right. You know, I speak parts of other languages. You know, I can get by in other, you know, in certain other language zones. I don't speak those languages. Not like I do English. Right. Communication is hard. Really, human communication with voice has so many intonations and run togethers and everything else that we interpret all the time. It's a classic example. It takes a lot more power than you think from 1950.
So there's another interesting phenomenon in human communication, and that is that when you're walking down the street with somebody talking to them, you are not communicating the information that they're receiving and that you're sending. And what you're in your brain trying to convey is not what they're receiving and not what they're getting in their brain. And yet somehow we do manage to get a mapping in our brain into some sort of a mapping in their brain through this ridiculous communication process we have of speaking, you know, but there's nobody gets anywhere close to understanding at this point in time how that map in my brain gets translated into a map in your brain, which is probably a completely different map that even that's carrying almost the same meme, right? Or how we're able to just communicate it all. And just one other thing in here, dogs, right? So dog trainers, they talk about this. My wife has her PhD in psychology. She also has a master's in dog psychology, effectively, and dog training. And, you know, it's a different species, but you're still, you can get that communication going to where somehow you understand what each other are saying to each other, even though there's not even a similarity in body, you know, different language, you know, it's amazing.
Both good analogies, right? You know, but as I was going to say, you can sneak up on yourself and catch how you do this sometimes, you know, be your own observer. And as you're saying, you're walking along, you're talking to somebody else. You're not just in your mind picking the words and saying them out of your mouth. You're picking the words, saying them out of your mouth, paying attention in various ways to the person you're talking to, whether they're paying attention, how fast they're walking, you know, all sorts of things. So the words you're picking are in the context of the situation you're in. So it's not even just the words, you know, the words in a different context, you know, wouldn't be as effective or effective at all. And we all do it all the time. Like you say, dogs do it. All the animals do it. This is how they communicate with each other. They communicate intent quite clearly. And it's, you know, so yes, getting computers to understand strings of English words spoken by humans and act like humans is not a low bar.
This show is brought to you by Management Analytics, trusted advisor since 1977.
Ron Ross from the National Institute of Standards and Technologies is unique among those in the cybersecurity industry in that he has been in charge of the development of federal standards and specifications for cybersecurity since those standards were first started in their development. As such, his work has probably affected more people around the world than any other person in the cybersecurity arena and moved the course of activities in this area forward at the scale of nation states and global corporations. Here's Ron.
Institute of Standards and Technologies.
Yeah, because that's where there was some computer security work going on there and you know, it was all unclassified type stuff out there. Trusted Information Systems was where a lot of the old NSA folks went from the Computer Security Center, like Chuck Flieger and Steve Walker. And there was just a brain trust of people out at TIS. So I spent my 3 months of waiting for my top secret SCI clearance at Trusted Information Systems in NIST, and I was picking everybody's brains. I was just saying, hey. So whenever I talk to a young person, I always stress one thing. I said, whatever you want to do, get grounded in the fundamentals. Because in my case, I had a degree in computer science and AI and robotics, but I got a shock and they sent me someplace else. But what I did have was all the fundamentals of computer science, and computer security is built on computer science. In fact, I would argue today that a lot of times we think we have cybersecurity problems when they're really, there's systems engineering and security engineering problems, mostly engineering stuff that we could fix to a large degree if we did things the right way with appropriate assurance. So long story short,
too late for that. Making a long story short, no, but that's all right. Take your time.
So to make a long story longer, 3 months goes by. I show up for work, and my boss is a guy named Blaine Berman. And there's, you know Blaine.
I do.
He was in the division, the NSA, that was the they were the authors and the producers of the Rainbow Series, the Orange Book, Red Book, all the different Rainbow Series books, which was really the first I believe serious work in computer security. I mean, the Anderson Report started everything and all of that, and you know the history better than anybody. But that was where I first came across this young guy named Fred Cohen. And Blaine, in those days, he said, I have some of the best and the brightest minds in computer, in what called it computer security back in those days. because NSA had two different focuses. They had one on ComSec, which is all the crypto and all the stuff that went into ComSec devices. Then they had
ComSec, communications security.
And then CompuSec, which with computer security. And these two entities never intertwined at NSA. They were separate but equal for many years. In fact, NSA had to develop the National Computer Security Center to separate the computer security folks from the ComSec folks. And that was probably a big mistake, but nonetheless, that's the way they rolled.
So, I think the equity issue comes in here, right? That is, so the crypto is largely about breaking crypto, and they don't want the people that are defending to understand how people are breaking it, because breaking it more important for the national intelligence capability than defending.
Yeah, and that equities issue, we could talk about that if we have time. That extended out into the CompuSec area as well. And that's another debate can rage for years. But so Blaine Burnham, my boss, I was a military officer at that point. I was getting promoted to lieutenant colonel at that time. I ended up becoming his deputy at some point. Then I took over the division from Blaine, but when I walked in the door, Blaine said, you know, we've got a brain trust of people here that are going to be able to school you in computer security. Roger Stell had just left the Computer Security Center in the 80s, a brilliant guy from MIT, Air Force Colonel. I know you know him as well. And so I was introduced to people like Jim Anderson and Earl Boebert and Chuck Flieger. And this young guy, Fred Cohen, and I remember reading articles about you at that point. You had done some very early research in virus technology and I think in forensics. And I think your work today is still cited as some of the seminal work in that field of our business. And so a lot of the younger people, unless you Google Fred, you may not ever know this, but I just wanted to so that's how I first came across you. But
hang on. So how did you encounter me in that context? Because while those folks knew of me, I certainly wasn't part of that game.
Well, I don't know if you remember this, but back in those days, we were still working on many of the books in the Rainbow series. And we had just finished the Red Book, which was the trusted network interpretation of the old Orange Book. The Orange Book was about trusted operating systems, but very quickly we learned that an OS in a single system, it's got to communicate. And so that spawned interpretations both for connecting between systems. That was the trusted network interpretation of the Orange Book. And then we had something called the TDI, the trusted database interpretation. So I kind of characterized this going out horizontally amongst the different systems and then going vertically from the operating system up to the application level, which would be a database running on top of an operating system. So we were still developing those key Rainbow Series documents. And I was also just starting to work on something called the federal criteria. We were trying to push the Orange Book out to the commercial side because NSA didn't do a very good job of pushing the Orange Book technology out to the vendors. They built the trusted systems, but we never mandated their use. And so that's where you
evaluation criteria, right? TCSEC.
Yeah, exactly right. And so whenever I needed to have some brain power on some key issues, I had contracts that were already negotiated with Aerospace Corporation, the MITRE Corporation, the Institute for Defense Analysis, and these individual brain trust people like Fred, Earl Boebert. And we actually went out to you many, many times and asked your input on some key things we were working on. And we would get your feedback, Earl Boebert, Chuck Fleer. We were just blessed to have the best and the brightest at that time on some of the cutting edge things that we were working on. So I know a lot of the people that listen to you today, I mean, how many years ago? That was back in 1990. That's 32 years ago, long time ago. And we've both come a long way since then. But that's where it all started.
A long time ago. Dot, dot, dot.
you know, I need to find, I was just racking my brain as I was listening, you know, because I need to find one of my friends named Dan who's been a lieutenant, because I have just photobombed all of this. You know, I say, you know, that I'm the youngest of the old folks in cybersecurity, because I came, you know, I was at TIS, Trusted Information Systems, in its last year, 1997. And the whitehouse.gov server was still sitting there in its own room, because that was, as I said, right, that, you know, that was the brain trust coming into that period. You know, the U.S. federal government sort of, you know, you and Rand and everyone else, you know, sort of circled around. It was a small, small crowd. By the time I got there, it bought by McAfee at the end. And basically, we were finding out that those, you know, gauntlet firewalls weren't what everybody needed, even though, you know, that was, you know, the world's leading group of experts on cybersecurity. But we then entered a new phase, you know, commercialization, where you're not going to have those people to support every company on Earth.
They were part of what everybody needed, but let's just get some clarity in here. I never worked for TIS.
Sure.
In that brain trust, while people may have come and asked me questions, I was never under contract to anybody there to do any of that stuff. I never got paid for any of it. So I think it's fascinating when you look back that far, the things that people seem to remember that I don't believe ever happened. So I think they have false memories of my impact or import.
Oh, you'd be surprised, right? You know, the conferences have changed so much, you know, since the pandemic, but they were changing anyways, right? You're becoming cliche, and we're trying to figure out how we do things, but the human connections are still so much of it. You know, the RSA conference in San Francisco, which is, you know, a huge event, 30,000 people. You know, I go back, you go back, you know, back to when it was, you know, three. And it's the ramifications, the ongoing implications of the work of the small group who started in some area of endeavor, you know, if, you know, as and if it becomes, you know, hugely adopted. It's just fascinating to see those ripples, you know, and, you know, but sometimes literally people like you and, you know, in some way me and Rand and Ron and Ross and all these folks we talked to, and the, you know, the stories we can tell about the thing we did. And if you look around the world today, you can say, oh, that's why the NIST cybersecurity framework has five stages. You know, not, you know, at least that's a lot of room for hope, I think, right? You know, you can look around and say, well, everything's been done, everything's locked in, everything's defined. It's like, no, we're working with evolving frameworks, you know, that in our topic, cybersecurity, we're pretty well right. The first time people sat down, you know, when you could say it was World War II and Alan Turing in that crowd, you could say it was, you know, Rand and you and your crowd, is all true enough. And we refine it down and we move forward. But no, it's not done. You know, it's built on ideas and conversations.
All right. I just want to be really clear that in this context, I really was, and, you know, to a large extent remain, an outsider.
Right.
I was never in any of those things that he talked about. I was always this guy on the other side of the wall. And it's fascinating that people put me in that context. I mean, I went and gave talks at various agencies and so forth. But during all of that time, the typical thing is I would go give a talk and they would clap or something. But that was it. They couldn't ask any questions because they didn't want to reveal what they were thinking about. Right. And it's just, it's such a bizarre, bizarre thing. And, I mean, later in my career, I ended up with, you know, whatever clearances and so forth, and ended up getting involved in all sorts of things. But people think of me as an insider, and I am really as much the classic outsider as you can get in the cybersecurity field.
You know, there's any number of lessons about social dynamics in that, right? You know, and it is an interesting community. You know, I think I've been inside and outside and all of the above, which sort of fits my modus operandi and all in all of this. But, right, yeah. And this is why I think it's great Hollywood material, because, you know, you have these pressure cookers, you know, that draw high intellect people, you know, quite often have all sorts of interesting characteristics and egos and so on and so forth, and it makes for great drama, and it's all true, right? You know, up against the backdrop of doing really serious things that need to be done for really, you know, important reasons.
Yeah, I think the stories are the more interesting part of it anyway. I got to tell you, who cares that, you know, oh, I did this or I did that. What's much more interesting is, you know, that this, you know, Rand, you know, talking about how he's doing operations on rats and he's killed all the rats, you know, and, you know, Ron talking about how he can, you know, but at his, in his day, you can move a vehicle a foot or, you know, however many feet, and then you'd have to wait a few minutes before you can move it to the next thing. And that motion through that process and the different bizarre stuff people, you know, look, how did he get to know about cybersecurity? How did he get involved in cybersecurity? Because he was going to do something else and somebody else decided to stay. So he had to find another job. So he's looking for a job and he gets a job, but he can't get cleared in time. So now he has to move to some other place, right? And when we were talking to Rand Waltzman, we had the same kind of thing, right? I mean, he ends up, you know, he got a job back at DARPA, but couldn't do it because he wasn't cleared. So he ended up, you know, going to somewhere else. And I don't know if you remember Peter Neumann, same thing, right? Yeah, I think it's fascinating. I think it's the same with you. You had plenty of occasions where you ended up, you know, you had to go find something you could do and you ended up in a new field because that's where you could find a job. And in my case, I never found a job. I just had to keep doing something else different because I needed to find something.
Yeah, the stories are fascinating for many reasons. They're engaging, you know, just because. But it's also, you can see, you know, out on the water, you can see manatees and dolphins by the influence they have on the surface of the water, right? And I love that sort of thing, right? You know, because that's, you know, our careers, you know, we're driven by personal circumstance and also by the shape of the world around us. You know, the nooks that I, as you say, that I keep nestling into tend to be opening up about the time I need something to open up. And I tend to be aware of them because I guess that's what I do. You know, I'm following these trends and it's like, you know, in the next couple of years, people are going to be doing a lot of this, which means they're going to need that, which is about now, someone probably needs a thing. They quite often have to define it, right?
All right. One other thing I wanted to bring up from that discussion, and that was when he started talking about connecting classified systems together with networks. And there's a fascinating story about that, which I don't think we have enough time to tell here this time. We may tell it another time. But just a warning, if you have two seemingly, you know, systems that meet the same specifications for security, the same model of security, they pass all the tests, and you connect them together with a network that pass all the tests, when you combine them together, it may very well not pass any of those tests. And the reason I know this is because, okay, and that's the story to tell another time. But just so we know, connecting things together, even though it might seem like it's simple and should work, no.
I have to lay out one of the other boundaries of that condition, though, is that they're connected anyways. Everything's connected. You know, the whole air gap thing. It's like, well, I'm not connecting these two things. They're connected by people. You know, the information goes in one set of eyes that's the feet they walk over there. You can't.
Not these systems. They were not connected by people. They were in different domains run by different people, and nobody was allowed to cross those boundaries.
Yeah. That
doesn't save you. Model mismatches and implementation mismatches. There are all sorts of stuff that can go wrong. That when you look at it, you would say, no, that couldn't happen. And then you actually look a little bit further and you say, oops, it happened. So, yep. You know, a lot of things that seem like they should be obvious, a lot of, especially in security, right? Because it's such a brittle business. Just sort of one bit going wrong by accident or by, you know, something from the sun, you know, a solar flare causes a little bit more interference and one bit gets interfered with in the wrong way and everything goes awry.
Well, but you didn't refute my point. You actually sort of came back to it, right? You know, and then, you know, yes, two classified systems may be, you know, accessed by different human beings, but those human beings can meet in the real world. My point is there's boundary conditions, and as you approach them, you know, you get into diminishing returns for security investment, you know, to just stick to that topic. But it's
right.
There's so many people out there, of course, you know, and this is the cyber show, and it's like, I want to be secure. It's like, that's not a thing.
Right? Yeah, it's
enough to get to whatever level is appropriate for you.
Yeah, well, the actual sentence is actually a senseless sentence.
Right.
This notion of being secure is not a state of being.
Brought to you by Angel to Exit. We help grow companies.
Here at the Cyber Show, we wish everybody a happy new year and a fruitful and successful 2024. Next week on the Cyber Show, Pete corners the market on fake IDs. Rand piles up a perfect record on brain surgery. Ron assures us that we aren't sure how sure we are and ties it up with a tight knot. More fraud, spies, and lies, and much, much more. Only on the Cyber Show. See you next week.
A good time and bow. A good time and bow. A string beating man and a fiddler for a band. A good time and bow.
The Cyber Show was brought to you by Management Analytics, trusted advisors since 1977.